So again, as I like to acknowledge a lot of people in my lab, and I left out some people who are just arriving, and I'm not sure if the list is complete. So if you don't see your friend there, then I'm sorry. This is somewhat changing these days. So obviously the brain can be studied at many hierarchical levels. And the one that sort of fascinates me is at the level of the what we call a neurocircuitry, neurocircuit. And what we really mean by neurocircuit and cell types is that Chuck talked about this yesterday, that in many brain regions there are maps of something. And these maps invoke some regularity or modularity. And often what we see is that some imaginary circuitry is sort of repeated over and over. And this is an idea. This is not, because no one actually has ever shown a neurocircuit. We talk about it, but it's not really have shown. But this is sort of an idea that there are repeated units. And because of repeated units, something that emerges, what we call a cell type. And cell type emerges because it has a certain position in this graph. And also, lately, in the last few years, it turns out to be that some of these cell types that have special position or response to incoming input, they're also genetically different. That is that. Yeah, it's. But you'd never shown actually a complete neurocircuitry. So I think that this is this idea, but I've never seen actually one circuit when we completely, you can say, well, here is an output neuron, and then I know all my input neurons, and then I know what they do. So you see some anatomy pointing, but we really talk a lot about this without ever knowing what these cells are doing in the circuitry and how they do it. Because simply there were no tools. There was no tool of saying that, you know, this number 5 is needed because this and this reason, because we don't yet have the gain and loss of function. For that to be causally say that this neuron is needed for a particular function. So there is some ideas that these things do this and that, but I'm not really sure that is real. So I think that there's a lot of research these days is going actually to show a neurocircuitry with its element, showing what these elements are doing. And so the questions that I'd like to address today is looking at an input-output system and try to explain the output by the dynamics and connectivity of its component. And as we see, that we are very far of knowing all the components. But what I'd like to get here is that how important is the dynamics of inhibition or the individual elements in computing something. And in this part, I will go into detail in one circuitry, but I like to suggest that at least in the retina, there are some, so hopefully some rules are coming out that might be true for other computations as well. And in the second part, I will use the mammalian retina is just a hardware to ask some general questions. In a hardware in which we can genetically identify neurons and manipulate them. And there will be two agenda here. One is looking at how a symmetry emerge during development. So the question is that you start, asymmetries are very important for neural computations, like in the visual cortex you see orientation columns. There are ganglions and retinal direction selective. And the question is that how does it emerge? Where is the initial break of symmetry? And so this is one question looking. And if I will have time, I'm not sure about that, I address another question that has to do about continuity, is that if I have some parameters here and I sort of turn a button and asking, you know, is that the output everything is continuous, or there are some discontinuities? And then here I will show you an amazing case of a neural circuit switch that you just change the parameters and suddenly it goes to a completely different state. I'm not sure if I'll have time, we will see. And the third part is that if you look at a rather complex circuitry, which becomes dysfunctional because you simply miss your input cells, how can we refabricate the circuitry to bring back visual activity or activity in a way that it makes sense, and that has more to do with medical applications. So along the lines, I will talk about usually four techniques. One that I find the most important ones, and it's only possible to do currently in the retina, and namely addressing cell types. And I will tell you exactly what I mean by that. Just bear with me. That means that genetically, some were able to bring a material to give a cell type. But the cell type, we have a rigorous definition, not just from classes of cells in principle. And the second, I will talk about a little bit of how you get connectivity maps. So that means that you know your output cells and you are interested, let's say, who are the cells giving input. And here I will talk about transgenic tracing, a bit about then the logistics of getting gain and loss of function. And this is the obvious one. A lot of you talked about state, input, and output of recording of cells. And so the model system we use is the mammalian retina. And the key reason we use it, because there is no input from the brain back to the retina. So that means if I isolate the retina, I can keep it in isolation for maybe eight hours. I can show all sorts of images to the retina and can record from every cell possible cells. And I don't have to worry about the fact that what I'm recording is might have nothing to do with reality because there's a lot of feedback from the brain. There's simply no feedback from the brain, or there's one pathway which is not really retinotopic, for which we ignore. And this is sort of our basic view of the retina, that the retina is a filter bank. It is simply a nonlinear filter bank, such that you have one video going to your eye, one movie, and what the retina is doing, it's creating a set of neural representations of the same incoming input. And so the first record, I mean, this has been recorded in the first one we did in 2001, and we realized that you keep recording from different ganglion cell types, and I don't go into the details how we get space-time maps, but it's remarkably different, the neural representation from ganglion cell to ganglion cell type. And what also came out, that this is like a very primitive view of the retina, because there are a minimum 30 types of these, or even more, of these messages. So what I like to suggest, and I'll get a bit into it, that the retina is more like the olfactory system. So this idea that there are X and Y type cells, it's just good that you can make two groups, and I can make two groups here, of course, without any problem. But once you get genetics and people like Andy Humerman and others are, and us and George Sainz and others getting it, and you start to account for the numbers that you have, more what emerges that these are features that extracted from the visual scene, just like olfactory features. And we really don't understand these features, and there's no way of predicting these features based on elementary principles. What our questions are, we are interested in, is what are these arrows? So first of all, what is the biological significance of a given feature? Yeah, I will talk about that. And second, what is the circuitry that creates this map? How this develops, and what can we do in blindness when you lose your input? And so very briefly, I introduce you to the retina. In daylight, the photoreceptor of interest is the cones, which are distributed across all the retina as a mosaic of cones. And every single cone talks to approximately 10 types of bipolar cells. So this is a legacy of Heinz Wessely, who showed essentially in all species we know is that this is true, that the cone talks to 10 types of bipolar cells, and the numbers never match what I say and what you see here, simply because there are just too many, and I don't like to draw so many. So here you see six, and they come in two categories, one of them called on-bipolar cells, which are activated when there's an increase of intensity, and off-bipolar cells, which are activated when there's a decrease of intensity. But the receptors here are also different at the dendritic tips of these bipolar cells. So essentially, they're acting as different temporal filters. Yes? 10. No, 10. 10. And so the axon terminals, they lay down in different strata. in the, what we call inner plexiform layer, and there's a very strict rule that the on-bipolar cells, they end in the lower strata, and the off-bipolar cells in the upper strata. Upper and lower, of course, has no meaning, and I'm just telling you, if I say proximal and distal, you will have absolutely no clue what it means, but on this picture, it's clear it's a lower and upper. But of course, in your eye, there's no lower and upper strata. And then there are ganglion cells which reach the dendrites to these strata, these different strata, read out what the bipolar cells are saying, and they become off, on, or on-off, depending on which bipolar cell they connect. And so this is, again, a very elementary picture in which there is one ganglion cell per stratum, but there are some strata which we know more than others. And so, for example, there's one stratum we can count minimum 7 types of cells. Okay, so if you multiply up with like 10 strata, there are a lot of ganglion cells. We don't know exactly the number. And this would be just some sort of a temporal processor because the different, you know, temporal filters are coming in. And what makes the retina is an interesting piece of hardware are the inhibitory neurons. And it's generally true for many brain regions. And there are two main types of inhibitory neurons. Ones that sort of make connections between different spaces. So this is present in each spatial point. And some endocrine cells have very large processes, and they do correlations across spatial points. And these tend to be in single strata. And there are other ones that are even more interesting, that these are very narrow cells. So those that I just talked about, the very large ones, are GABAergic. And the narrow ones are glycinergic. And they span these different strata, and they create rules of recombining this different information arriving to different strata. And you can see pretty much all combinations. So it's the one that it's in stratum 1, talks to stratum 3. Usually they pick up information in one stratum and deliver it to another one. There are many, many combinations. And these are glycinergic amacrine cells. So, if you now concentrate on a single type of ganglion cell, this is our imaginary view that in each type of ganglion cell has one or two bipolar cells giving inputs and then few amacrine cells in it and has a local circuitry. And these local circuits then they mosaically arrange in the retina with some sort of a tiling rule. And this then, of course, this this would look at an image and would pick up different components, and that's how you would get an output feature. Now, what's important is that you don't have only one type of photoreceptor. At nighttime, the photoreceptor is no cone but rods, and rods do something very different. So rods came much later in evolution. And I'll show you here what is called the classical pathway. And that is rods talk to one type of bipolar cell. This is called rod bipolar cells. It's a bit simplified image that I tell you. And these are on bipolar cells. And then these guys then talk to a very fancy amacrine cell that has processes in most retinal strata. And this is a very fancy one. It's called A2 amacrine cell because it's neither excitatory nor inhibitory, but both. And so in the upper strata, this is inhibitory, this is a glycinergic amacrine cell. In the lower strata, this is excitatory because it's gap junctionally coupled back to the cone bipolar cell terminal. Okay, so this A2 is inhibiting the bipolar terminals in the upper strata and exciting the lower strata. And you see this incredibly beautiful design is that although you have one type of bipolar cell, you just hook into the evolutionary earlier cone circuitry. So information just comes here and it sort of bypasses these cell bodies and arrives to these different bipolar terminal, and then everything is normal. Okay, so then you have all the computer already there because amacrine cells will compute on the cone bipolar terminal message. It's a really cool design. So this is about just introducing the retina, and to show you what and how the retina computes, I'd like to show you one computation and a little bit about the circuitry. And before doing that, however, I'll show you, discuss how we address cell types, and this will be very important in what I say. And 5 years ago, before people like Andy, Josh, and us started to look for mouse that expresses certain markers in ganglion cell types, there were simply no mouse lines around, maybe one or two, that you could target your electrode. Now, if you have a hardware in which you have 30, 40 types of ganglion cells, you have essentially no chance of going back to the same ganglion cell type. And especially in mouse, and they just look identical. And so that means that pretty much before 5 years ago, we couldn't really ask a question about what exactly and how a circuitry computes, because simply physically we could not go back to the same cell type targetedly. So at that time, we decided that we take a sort of a blunt approach, and we received eyes from the GeneSet project, and many of you know what is that. If you don't know, they simply started to put GFP in back transgenics, choosing a given gene based on some idea, which is not clear to me, and then putting GFP and hoping that the regulatory regions will be actually the correct regions, make a transgenic mouse, and you get a mouse line, which is some GFP expression. Now, what turned out to be is that in many cases, the pattern does not reflect the original gene expression pattern. However, we thought that we cannot care less about the genes at that time. All what we want is mouse lines in which can target specific cell types. And if you do such a screen in amygdala, you arrive nowhere, because there are no rules about how spatially these cells are arranged. But in the retina, we know, again, from a lot of work for anatomists, and I would again mention Hans Wesley as one of the key person in this, that these amacrines and ganglion and bipolar cells are sort of stratified in strata. So we saw that we have, and also we know their cell bodies are arranged. So we saw that we go through, make a quantification, and this is essentially we three-dimensionally reconstructed all of these retinas, but didn't do it like manually. We sort of automatized a bit things, and then we wrote an algorithm that simply pulled out if a given mouse line has a certain stratification and assigned a number to it. So we get a code for the cell body and for the stratification. And so I don't want to too much go into that, just say that by now there are around 100 different mouse lines in which maybe few combinations or single cell types are labeled with GFP. And what it allows us to do is allow us to target for recordings. And for example, also what it allows us to do, that let's say we're looking at a ganglion cell and we have some ideas which amacrine cell might be involved in the computation, because we know that it's in a given stratum. And then we can look at those mouse lines and make some recordings. So almost everything what we do, indeed absolutely everything, is from mouse lines in which we have genetically labeled cell types, because otherwise we can't really ask questions about computation. Yeah, because it's a back. So the back, because it's just random. It's random integrates. This is unknown. It could be, it just integrates somewhere and it could disrupt, and we just don't know this. This is a good point. We have absolutely no clue about this currently. So this is step number one. Now, what's the problem of this that is still, this is just allows you to record from cells, but when you want to engineer, let's say, clearly combinase, such you can retrofit them with viruses, you cannot just use backs, because most of the time you pick the same back, you put in clearly combinase, you get completely different. And we and others exercise this and get made, like 50 mouse lines, and maybe 3-4 would work. Yes? That would not be a cell type. Very strictly in our word in our head, we think that if you see something, if the cell body, even the cell body position is all over, we would not call it a cell type. And I have to say that there are very few which are absolutely clean only one cell type. Like this is very, it's a very good one here. Then you see the mosaic spacing. So you need couple of definition. One is mosaic spacing. You don't need tiling because most ceramic synthesizers, they don't tile. There are also some which are not in one stratum, but two or three, but very repeatedly there. So you always see bends. And even that's not so, we started a program. So we have a very hardcore definition of cell type, and that's the following. We take one of these mouse lines, and we have a machine in which we can try out many, many antibodies. So we have 100 antibodies, we run through all of them, and if all the 100 precisely labels all the same cells, we call it a unique cell type. I'm not going to go into this. This is a sort of process that we go through right now. But what I'd like to get is that there's still a problem, how do we bring genetic material to these things? And you cannot do simply making back transgenics because the rate by which you get right ones are just not very high. So what, yeah?
Sorry, so the stratification seems like a great way to pool cell types or cell type. But like, for instance, the on-off direction selective cells all would be stratified in the same depth within the retina, but we know like,
No.
At an initial screen, it makes sense, but would you then call that one type?
No, definitely not. Okay. Definitely not. I mean, again, I didn't want to go into too much details, but just because this is the initial screen that you find some in one, but then we go with physiology and look in that restricted set if it's really want to, but it's not enough by far. However, if you go with very large number of antibodies, you will see that they start to, that they always find one or two that diverge. So that's why fingerprinting, antibody fingerprinting helps. So what I like to get is that to actually target your what you want to target, you have to go to one step further. And so what we have been doing in the last 4 years is that we fact sort out from each of these mouse lines, now we are at around 30 mouse lines, it's 25, the cells and put on gene chips. And again, what we know, and this we do for the relatively pure cell types, and then we ask what are the genes that are really expressed in that, and then we do the following. So here, for example, it's a horizontal cell. I haven't talked about it, sorry. And this, what we found was really remarkable. So you could argue that maybe there will be one or two genes specific for a cell type. That's not what we found. We found that at least, you know, 10 to 20 genes completely specific in the retina to given cell type. So what you can do, two things. One is that you pick one of these and make a Cre knock-in. So that's one thing that we're doing, and that you can be ensured that is normal, at least most of the time it's the original locus and you get an expression pattern that you wanted. And the second one is that we try to build AAV viruses in which we have a sort of combine enhancer regions from all of these 10 and make AAV viruses. Again, I don't want to go in details because that's irrelevant. But this is what we'll talk about. One is that we can now target recordings. We can make Cre transgenic lines knowing these genes. And we can start to make viruses with specific promoters. This is very, very early times for this because we have few of these, but most of them, I mean, this is just too early. But this is the logistics. So here is one mouse line, and this is it's before the screen. So we just luckily found this mouse line being in an institute with a lot of genetics. And this is the PV-Cre mouse line. And if you look it is a living mouse, and look in the eye of this living mouse, you see some nicely bright cells. And if you open up the retina, this is what you see. It's a live image of the retina. And then you can see that there are some cells, and all of them turn out to be ganglion cells. So we spent some time, we recorded approximately 1,000 of these ganglion cells, reconstructed them, and it turned out to be that they are from eight different types, morphological, physical, physiological, and they all match. Yes? I'll get to that. This is very, very important, and I'll get to that. We are working on human retinas now, and we get to that point later. And then we have just an experimental setup, which is a projector, and the retina sits here, and a two-photon microscope, an infrared camera, and then we record. So, and what we record is essentially four variables, only three shown here. We can record the spiking output by coming with an electrode in the on-cell patch mode, and then we come with another electrode, we break into the cell, And by clamping TRIPS and putting all sorts of blockers, we can record the inhibitory and excitatory input to that cell, or approximate these inputs. And in some cases, we also measure the state of the cell by coming yet with a third electrode, actually before this, and recording the voltage. Okay, but mostly I will talk about output and input. And this comes from MCRN cells, the inhibitory input, and from bipolar cell comes the excitation. So what I will talk about is one computation in the retina. And so when we target here a very, very large ganglion cell, and very large ganglion cells are particularly interesting because they have small ganglion cells, where they look at the pixel and do some computations. The large one interesting because a lot of things is going on within the dendritic field of this cell. So this is actually looking at 10 degrees of visual angle, so that means in the mouse you have approximately 15 across. It's not a lot of cells. And that's why you have so many cell types, because the large cells, they have much more than the small cells, obviously. And this is in a particular layer. And so if you see a large cell, the very obvious thing to do is look at motion. So how it computes motion. And we get a major surprise, which for a long time I thought it's an artifact, but it didn't turn out to be an artifact. So what we presented is a small bar. This is a black bar. This was actually an off cell, so we present a black bar, and then move its edges right or the left, and here is a different velocity. So here is the velocity of the left edge, the right edge, and the velocity of the right edge, left to the right, and we present a large number of videos. So here we record the cell, randomly presenting different videos, and in each video we pick a speed for the left and for the right edge. And if you do that, you would imitate approaching motion in this quadrant, lateral motion in sort of this axis, and shrinking motion here, and the combination of thereof. And we simply counted spikes, what the cells do. And the spikes do was something really, really peculiar. And here the diameter of this patch is the number of spikes, is that this cell does not respond at all to lateral or shrinking motion, except to approaching motion. And that was particularly amazing to me, because every time you poke at something in the cortex, you start the question, am I recording from a cell? You show a drifting gradient. And this cell is absolutely not responding to drifting gradient, so we completely miss. By the definition, you want to find a cell response, you would miss this, because this would be absolutely not responding to that. Okay. So normally, in the old time, we also started with some moving thing. We would say, oh, this cell is just a bad recording, go to the next one. Now, the first point you can make is that, well, this I put here approach, but it's a little ambitious definition, because there is dimming. Like, okay, if I increase a black thing here, there's dimming in the receptive field, and every off cell would respond to dimming. And it does, it's an off cell response to dimming, but a normal off cell would respond also to lateral motion, but yet it's more than a dimming detector. And this can show by an experiment where we keep the total amount of light falling on the retina, on the ganglion cell, constant. And while we are sort of expanding, we are balancing for the intensity change. And you see that the cell, even then, it responds to motion. So this cell has two properties. It's a dimming detector in one hand, so it does not respond to lateral motion. But it also, there is some nonlinearity that it likes the expansion of edges. No, absolutely not. So we have this thought that this might have some sort of an alert function for the mouse, because it's quite important to detect certain kind of motion. So what is the circuit? It's how the cell comes up with not responding to lateral motion. And it was almost immediately clear when we look at the structure and of its input. So what you see is really interesting. So here, it gets excitation from bipolar cells at the dimming phase. So here, we just show a spot, like a spot to the ganglion cell, essentially a dark spot on the gray background. And as you expected, an off cell responds to it. It's a dimming detector, so it's an off cell. But the inhibition comes at the brightening phase. So that sort of puzzles you, because if you would just show spots to the cell, This would be a crazy idea to do, because inhibition always comes when there's no excitation, so there's not really a lot of sense that's made to make inhibition when there's no excitation. It's like telling your kid to don't talk when he's not talking. And so it's rarely the case. So, but obviously, when you think about the circuitry and the, so what you see here is a very, very large ganglion cell, and it gets input from off bipolar cells, that's why it's dimming, and it gets input through an amacrine cell from on bipolar cells. That's the only way you can get inhibition and brightening. So this is, we know from a lot, we know a lot about retinal anatomy, and it's the only possibility this can happen. Okay. Now, what we also know, that these coming experiments I don't show, that these excitation and inhibition came from local subunits. So we could make up a very simple model in which you have brightening causing inhibition and dimming causing excitation in local subunits. And there's a very big ganglion cell that integrates together. So the idea is very simple, that if an object approaching, you know, look what happens at the edges, it is a change detector, it's a transient cell, that is only pure dimming at the edges, the only change that happens is dimming. So this would cause excitation, pure excitation. And if you have a translational motion, lateral motion, at the front edge you would see dimming, but at the trailing edge there will be always exactly the same number of pixels would show you brightening. So if this would cause inhibition, this is excitation, the result would be zero. And we were very, very happy to discover this. Indeed, this is a project by Thomas Münch and Rava da Silveira, until we noticed that something is really not that good. And yes? I'll talk about all the details a bit later then. So this was originally an idea that here's a very big ganglion cell, and what I'm talking about is motion within the receptive field, within its field of the ganglion cell for now, and later address this other problem. And the problem was that we get suspicious a bit about our fantastic model, is that you have seen here that in the circuitry, that there are two cells here and one here. So in any feed-forward inhibition, there must be a delay. And what we have seen is really very little spiking. So the question was really, this whole thing was stinking. And so when we thought, well, great, in this mouse, we have actually more than one ganglion cell type. We have eight. And we had another off cell that was equally large in another stratum. We thought, we just go ask if this ganglion cell would have the same structure, inhibition, excitation structure. And so the question was, every large off ganglion cell is approach sensitive. That would not really fit the bill. So we went to this other cell, which is called, this cell is called PV5. This is the approach sensitive. We went to this other cell, which is called PV6. And this cell was clearly responding to lateral motion. So every time at the initiation of motion, there was a large burst of spikes. So we asked this, now if you look at inhibition and excitation, would they come at different structure than in PV5 cells? And the answer was no. This ganglion cell also had an on inhibition of excitation. So that somehow suggests that possibly we are all wrong, and that inhibition has absolutely nothing to do with approach sensitivity. And this, we refuted this hypothesis by looking at my blocking inhibition. So here you see an approach sensitive cell, the PV5 cell, during lateral motion in a control condition, and when we block all inhibition by blocking the on system. And you see that this cell is not responding to lateral motion, but when we block the on system, it gives you a transient burst. And this is precisely coinciding with this inhibition that comes into the cell that gets blocked. And there's no change for approaching motion. So this is telling us that inhibition is needed, because if we block inhibition, it responds to lateral motion. So then what is the trick? So what we started to get into, that maybe there is something very fancy about the circuitry, that it creates a fast dynamics. There's a dynamic difference between inhibition between these two cells, and just this dynamics of inhibition is enough to convert a cell for responding to lateral motion, not responding to lateral motion. And this is When you blow up the inhibitor input during light on from PV5 and 6 cells, this is exactly what you see. See, here is the PV5 cell, which is the approach sensitive cell. There's this fast inhibition, and this later phase of inhibition is precisely the same as in the other cells. So the PV6 cell, which responds to lateral motion, is missing a fast component. So where does it come from? And we could show that this fast component is relevant by it's in the right time scale. So I don't want to go too much in that. But this fast inhibition comes precisely in the time when you block the response to the initiation of motion during lateral motion. So what's the difference? What's the physical difference between these circuit pathways? And so here, a year passes, and I'm not going to go tell you all the experiments, but sort of we looked at every single synapse possible, except of one. We haven't looked at this on-bipartite-on amacrine synapse, because according to the retinal dogma, this is just a glutamatergic synapse from on-bipartite to on amacrine cells. So that we thought it's uninteresting. We just did a lot of other experiments with other synapses, doing pharmacology. And nothing ever, they just looked identical. So finally saw that maybe there's something wrong with the retinal dogma. So we started to ask, is it really glutamatergic, this synapse? And what you see, what we saw was really amazing, is that in the PV6 cell, which is responding to lateral motion, we could block all inhibition by putting glutamatergic blockers. However, if you put the same blockers, so we are blocking this synapse here, and we try to block this, the initial transient fast inhibition that is needed for blocking lateral response to lateral motion is still remained. And then again, a year of trying out just about everything possible until we realize that maybe the real trick is that you have an electric synapse here. And if you have an electrical synapse, somehow from two synapses you make one. This is a little bit too much, but you can fasten up transmission here so that you can synchronize the inhibition excitation arriving by sort of shunting this synapse. So then another 2 years passes, and so we're getting some mice, and now you have to do a lot of crosses. So you have to realize that an experiment like this, we have four alleles in the same mouse, so we can see the cell and its homozygous for connexin 36, plus we have other connexins which didn't work. And here we get a very clean answer that in the connexin 36 knockout, there's absolutely no fast inhibition. And then in that knockout, we can convert the PV5 cell from not responding to lateral motion to responding to lateral motion. Yes? Yes. Yes. So this all what I've shown. Yes, it is not correct. No. You're right. This is incorrect. It is necessary to block response to lateral motion. This is correct. So doing this, of course, is still very abstract because I haven't shown you the cell. So I'm giving a lot of prediction. There is an amacrine cell, a fancy one, and it's electrically symmetrically connected, and it's just storytelling. So we thought that we have to really look at who is that partner. And at that time, transsynaptic tracing did not, I will show you real good transsynaptic tracing. At that time, we didn't have it working well. So we thought that we just have one electrode targeting the genetically identified cell, and the other one you randomly poke into the middle of the retina and looking for synaptic partners. And that's not a very high throughput experiment. But at one point, we found the cell, and this cell was very clearly driving an amacrine. It's a flat mount retina, it's not so easy to patch clamp cells in the flat mount retina in the middle. But then we found a cell which, when we then excite this cell directly by the electrode, then we see an inhibitory current in the ganglion cell, which is blocked by strychnine. And we knew that this was a glycinergic inhibition. We thought, well, we have the one. And then, of course, then we feel this cell, and you see this was the MX that recorded two cells, the ganglion cell. Here you see this small cell, which is exactly fitting our definition of the subunit. And this turned out to be a cell type called the A2 amacrine cell. And here you can see the ganglion cell dendrite, and this is the amacrine cell. Now, why is this important? Because now we can go to this amacrine cell and redo all the experiment if that fits the bill. And first of all, we use a marker that marks A to M eccrine cells, so we can be sure that it's A to M eccrine cell. And here are some other controls. And the important point comes here. So when you have an A to M eccrine cell, still it's a random patch. So randomly patching A to M eccrine cells is no fun, I tell you, because there are like 30 types of M eccrine cells. So what we do now is going back to our genetic library of mouse lines, which we already had in hand, and simply pull out the A to M eccrine cell. So now you can sort of map the problem to another mouse line in which you can target your electrodes. And then here is to show you that PV5 cell responds to approach motion. You record now to A to M eccrine cell, repeat exactly all these videos I showed you, and this is responding to lateral motion and receding motion, but not to approach motion. So this, the idea is that this is the inhibition that provided to these guys to get rid of lateral motion. You can apply CPPNBQX, which is blocking the glutamate input I talked about, and this is keeping it intact, and then you can block it with an on with blocking inhibition that essentially blocks this cell, and I showed you before that adding APB indeed makes the cells responsive to lateral motion. Okay, so I'd like to talk a bit about this computation. Is what's important here is the size mismatch between pre and post synaptic cells. So one clear the only way you can do that, the small subunits and a very large ganglion cell. And it's organized in sort of push-pull subunits. And what the circuit tries to achieve is matching the dynamics of inhibition excitation. And despite all of the synapses, you can do that by electric synapses. And one thing I have not talked about is this question, is that what, so this is explaining the linear component. It explains you why it's not responding to lateral motion. What it does not explain, what I told you, is why is that so that if you keep the intensity zero, there's no change of intensity, it still responds to edges. And that comes from a nonlinear filtering at the tip of bipolar cells, at least that's what we believe, because if you have expanding edges, you concentrate all your energy at the edge. While if you just keep the intensity balanced, so if you have a nonlinear synaptic filtering, you put more weights on a high energy parts, and that's how you create a response to zero average input. So there are a couple of important points. One is that I'm sort of making the case that it's important for approaching objects. But what if I approach you? Okay, would this cell respond? So we did the experiment, and the cell does not respond. And it's very clear why not. And the way we did it is we took what happens if I approach you, that there are many details, like I approach Venki, there are many details on the face. Some of them are off and on subunits, and they equally expand, so you get zero response. But if you have something approaching you, that particular object, especially if it's coming from the sky, is expanding. The second important point that only post-centric inhibition provides this veto signal, because you have to combine inhibition from very large regions. It's maybe a point that only retinal people will get. Now, there are also ambiguities. So what's important, the reason I showed you this circuitry is because it also shows you that the retinal cells are broadly tuned. So it's the retina does not create absolutely specific filters that would tell you that you have a certain angle in your hair, but it creates some pre-filters. So in each case, we know at least from retinal ganglion cells, there are ambiguities. And one ambiguity, for example, that a recessing white object will elicit an object, a response, clearly. So this has to be, if this is a building block for an approach-sensitive neuron, it has to be taken care later. And the second one is that if you just enter the receptive field, you will create a response. And you can solve this problem because these cells are 50% overlapping by next stage. So of course, one should follow this up, what happens later. The good news is there is this amazing new finding in human patients, is that you can lack your complete V1. So you can get rid of V1. And ask what this patient sees. The patient does not see you. It sees one thing, approaching motion. So there's somehow approaching motion seems to be specifically directed toward V2 on others that you can use even when you are lacking, you have a thrombose, or you have a get rid of your V1 computations. We don't yet know where this cells projects because we just try to do this currently. Sure. Absolutely. So we looked back our library of ganglion. This cell in the mouse we don't have, but in rabbit we found this cell. So in rabbit with this is the equivalent.
Is there a tendency for these cells to be distributed across the retina in a way that fits with the idea of them as moving detectors? Consistent with the idea of moving upper visual field, or
something
that you care about
coming out as well? Yeah. So here's the point is that see, this cell, the more you put in a given region, the less approach sensitive it is. See, because if you think through, it's exactly the opposite. But I think what you just said, because what's important is a very large field. So that the more you put an area, the more it will respond to this incoming lateral motion. So what you want is as little as possible. We don't fully know the complete distribution of these cells, because in this mouse line, not every of the same class is labeled. So the answer for that is unknown. What is consistent is that they have a large overlap, which would be important because then you would detect any start of an approach. Now, what time is this? We have half an hour. So what I'll try to do is spend 10 minutes on the problem of the emergence of asymmetry, and I try to be faster, and then another 20 minutes in reconstructing circuits in blind patients. So here you probably have heard about this is a directional cell. So the question is how circuit asymmetry emerges, and this is what we call is a directional selective ganglion cell. All of you know, you have probably heard about this. Some of you, that there is a type of ganglion cell, actually several types, which if you show this sort of motion to the ganglion cell, it responds in one direction more than in another direction. So this is known for like 40 years. And this is called what's called the preferred direction and the null direction shown here. And in 1967, people recorded from many of these units in the ganglion cell layer and found something really amazing, shown here, that you don't have directions for all directions in the retina, only four. Okay, so you have upward and downward motion, temporal to nasal, but not others. Okay, so you have a motion coordinate system at every point in the retina, which decomposes motion. By the way, we think that the approach sensitive is just a z direction to the same system. And so what is known about this is that there is a type of amacrine cell called starburst amacrine cell that gives input to each of these directional selective ganglion cell. And the way it's hooked up is that if this is the preferred direction, this amacrine cell that releases both GABA and acetylcholine is releasing less GABA when you have motion this way, and there's more GABA, not, we don't know, release. The weight of connectivity is weaker from here than from here. Okay, and this was shown in Nature and Nature Neuroscience. There's a number of people shown, really, you can get rid of the starburst amacrine cell, and the system will not be directional selective. Now, what excited us is that how on earth this develops. And the reason it's an interesting problem, because it's known from people like Marla Farren and others, that right after eye opening, it's already direction selective, and you have four of these cells, but seemingly they get input from the same amacrine cell. So how you hook up a coordinate system from the same amacrine cell such a way that somehow from one side you are direction, you are have little input, and from the other side more, if all four directions are represented. So this is sort of the Hollywood picture that is shown here. I'd like to go more into exactly how the circuitry looks. So this is a starburst amacrine cell. And what's important is all of these processes sort of go outwards. And it was shown by Winfried Denk beautifully that actually all what's inside does not matter. The release property depends on motion outwards on these on these tips. So that means if you have a motion this way, this particular process will release a neurotransmitter. If you move this way, it will not. But the consequence of this is actually the cell body and all this does not matter. These are local motion detectors. And if you move this way, it releases neurotransmitter. This way is not really neurotransmitter. Now, the second point, which is important, is that these starburst hemicrine cells, they don't tile. They really overlap. So it's one starburst hemicrine, there's two. But then if you wait, and there's a lot, right? So there's a whole stratum. Now we abstract out the information from this. So at every point in space, you have these little little vectors coming from all over. Each vector has a different cell body, but cell body does not matter. Indeed, there's a famous experiment of eliminating the cell bodies and leaving directional selectivity intact. Now, the second important point, that if this is a ganglion cell, it has at each point in space, it has these little vectors coming in. And at each point is directional selective. That's what keep pressing. That it's, so if you move locally, it would respond this way, but not this way. So the local directional selectivity somehow hooked into the circuitry. And what I'll talk about is one information and a model that sort of helps us to drive ourselves where it might, how it might hook up. So this will be a problem similar that Fred was talking about, that you have to do some local things and then globally. Yes? No, absolutely not. The starburst not at all. So that's why I show you. The starburst is all directions. So you have a spectrum, all directions. The first question we will ask, if developmentally, first, it goes in a symmetric state, and then you choose somehow the right angles, or when they come, you just come in, they just know where to go. It's miraculously, they just know, come in. Okay, so that's the first question. And this is what I will answer. And the second is exactly when it happens during development. And the second part will be a model, which I try to show a model how this could happen without all the starburst hemicrine being the same. I'd like to show you how this could happen. That's pure model. So what we start again is a mouse line, and this is made by Keisuke Yonehara, a postdoc in my lab, while he was at Japan. And so he made the knock-in mouse line in just single type of directional selective cells labeled. And it is a subtype, but I don't go in too much in detail. And so what you see is a complete mosaic here. There's a mess on one side of the retina. But on the other side, every single cell responds to one orientation. Okay. So the first question he asked is that we know the starburst cells are the cells connected to it at late times. But are the starburst cells connected during development, which matters? It's a very important question because they might change partners and who knows what. So what he set up is an experiment when he wanted to identify in each day the neural circuitry of these cells during postnatal development. So he used the rabies virus, which at Calavay has been developed with Konzelman in Munich, that they had a G-deleted rabies virus. And what I didn't tell you, that this particular type of ganglion cell projects to a small nucleus called the medial terminal nucleus, not into lateral geniculate and supraculiculus. And only two types of ganglion cells project there, one that is labeled by GFP and another one which is also directional selective, but it's an opposite direction and it's unlabeled by GFP. And so what he does, he takes a rabies virus, injects at P0 into the medial terminal nucleus. And you have to be pretty much Japanese to do that, because no one on Earth could do this experiment, because this nucleus is probably 30 micron, and he just does and injects there, and now you will see the pictures, it just gets there. Now, this is what I have no time, I would never even consider this experiment. Well, medial terminal nucleus. This is the accessory optic tract. It's sort of, it comes, it's, well, it's in the brain somewhere. Yeah. Okay. So he starts with the control experiment when he injects his virus, which is MCHERRY, it's red. And then he shows that he injects into the transgenic mouse line. And he shows that now that these used to be green dots are also red. And that's why you don't see green dots here. And they're precisely two times red spot than green because there is another ganglion cell. The numbers are really amazing. It's 2 to 1. And then he looks at high resolution, and you can see that the GFP cell is also red, and another red cell is not GFP, and he goes and records, and that's precisely the other direction. Here there's just no, this experiment is just very clean. There's two types and 1 to 1. Now,
but
his entropy P0. Exactly, in P0. And I ask him how it is. He always mumbles that, okay, I say, how many mouse you have to inject to get this? He doesn't answer that.
So
yeah, yeah, exactly. So one is upward and one is downward, yeah?
It's 30 microns and 5.
It's 30 to 40 in P0, yeah. So it's, you have to do, you calculate how many injections I would do to get here. Sorry? But okay, it doesn't matter if you inject a little bit more, but you have to get to the region, right? Because well, it's not 30 micron, maybe 40 micron average volume diameter, right? So
the key is that it's far away from all the other retinas.
Exactly.
Yeah. So not to take anything away from this targeting skills, but you can afford to inject a slightly larger volume, but just get these cells.
Yeah. So the numbers, don't take my numbers seriously. It's small. Okay.
How many cells can you do?
So we can actually, we know it exactly. If it's precisely two, well, you count the numbers, and that's what it is. Now, so what he does then is that, so we try to then bring in a G-encoding virus, which would give, you know, many of you, if you don't know, rabies virus is a transsynaptic virus, but it's not able to pass retrogradely if it's missing this G protein. So the trick here is that we make another virus supplement the G protein. And this we tried to do for a long time, nothing ever worked. And the reason we figured out, although it's unpublicized, that both the rabies virus is really not very good for cells. It's killing them on the long run, I mean, 10 days. But you have to come with a virus that is precisely the same timing of making this G, then the rabies is actually replicating. And by the time we realized, my lab is working a lot on herpes viruses, so we realized that herpes virus is the perfect complement for G, because they have exactly the same replication site, not replication site, same timing of making G, this protein, then the rabies replicates. Okay. So what we made is a herpes virus that is non-transsynaptic, but then we mixed up the two viruses and inject. And again, you can say that, well, the odds that the two same cells will pick up the virus is close to zero, but I showed you that it's very efficient, this rabies, and the herpes is also very efficient. So you get some. And then we play around the titers. Again, it's like 200 or 300 mice injected. But now here you see one that now you inject both, and you see the local circuitry of some of these. And I will focus into more closely into this. You see clumps. Instead of single cell, you see now clumps. And what you see in the clump is really amazing. So in each clump, you see either one or zero GFP neurons, and precisely in the middle. And around it, there are some other cells. And the other cells, 90% of them are starburst hemacrine cells for which we have a marker. Okay, so then he plays his game over and over different days, and he comes up with something that what we know that by P6 and P5, starburst cells are connected. This is very, very important. Now what, this of course does not tell you anything about asymmetry, but then he makes another strategy. So he says that the viral tracing cannot elucidate synaptic weight, what we're looking for. But he already knows the time they're hooked up and when they're not hooked up. So now he changes strategy to the following strategy and uses optogenetic tools in another way. So what he makes now, he takes a mouse line which has clearly combinase only in starburst hemacrine cells, crosses to the one that has a single type of directional selective cell, and makes a virus which is expressing mCherry and chenodopsin conditionally. Okay. There's one genetic trick that was very important here to get this working is the following. Is that normally, if you use these chenodopsins, that it's a fusion protein between, let's say, mCherry and chenodopsin. But you know, one thing you don't know is that how much, if you use a virus, there are different amounts of expression in different cells. So you somehow have to calibrate your cells. And if you have a membrane tag, it's impossible to do. There's no way you can do it. So what he then does is using a self-cleaving a self-cleaving peptide called the 2E element from a from another virus, another virus genus, and it puts between channel rhodopsin and mCherry. So each time you have one transcript, but when you make the protein, it cuts exactly two. Okay, so you have exactly the same number of mCherry as channel rhodopsin, but mCherry is soluble. And that was a key trick to get this work. And then there's another point that he's not using a normal channel rhodopsin, but another one is more sensitive. So we get this from Hans Bamberg. And then he first shows that the fluorescent intensity of cell is correlating very well with the change of membrane potential in the starburst cells. Okay. And then he does the following experiment. He has this mouse and some AAV. So the starburst hemacrine cells have channel rhodopsin, and simply he uses the overhead projector and goes and figures out, while recording from the ganglion cell, figuring out the synaptic weight. And synaptic weight for two things, because I said that this cell is releasing acetylcholine as well as GABA. So there are two things here, GABA and acetylcholine. So he can clamping trick, you can figure out which one is which. And then he shines light, and he see an inhibitory current that can be blocked by GABAergic blockage, an excitatory current that can be blocked by cholinergic blockade. I don't show all this, the controls. And this is what then he does. He does a mapping, and he gets a polar plot. Okay, and a polar plot for the weight of inhibition and excitation at different days he does experiments. So here he just shows you at P8, the whole system is already directional selective. Okay, it's way before eye opening. And he shows then what he called an asymmetry index, namely how asymmetric is this distribution in the axis of the preferred and null direction. And he shows that by P8, this is almost completely asymmetric. It's like 0.8 asymmetry. I don't go into how we calculate that. But immensely interestingly, the excitatory input is symmetric. Okay, from the same cell, the cholinergic input is symmetric, and the GABAergic input is asymmetric. And essentially, the next two slides are the results. He goes from P6 to P9. You see that P6, this is now inhibitory weight from different directions, is symmetric. There's a random distribution, but the average is symmetric. And in 2 days, it's completely symmetric, asymmetric. So in 2 days, you start with a symmetrically connected circuitry. At P3, the synapses start to develop. Then there is a symmetric intermediate state. And then in P8, you are the asymmetric. Okay.
So it all fits, but I'm curious, is he tracking the orientation of the retina?
Exactly. Yeah, exactly.
Imagine there's an asymmetry, but it doesn't necessarily line up with the eventual.
So this mouse line is really amazing, because this mouse line has an internal marker of the upward and the downward. So he precisely he puts down the retina, such as always, this is the ventral and this is the dorsal ventral. Exactly.
The mass is
the mark. So this mass you have seen before turns out to be precisely in the ventral domain. So he doesn't need anything, just orients it, and he gets precisely. That was shown before in his publication. That's how we orient. So that's very important that this is actually upward and downward direction. So this is all aligned correctly. Now, you look at excitation, and that blows my mind. Excitation remains symmetric all over from the same cells. Okay, so now what are going on? So from now on, I present you a model. And I present you a model for inhibition, and I tell you why I think excitation might remain symmetric. So what I've shown you, that at P6, the connectivity, the local connectivity is symmetric, and at P8, it's asymmetric. So how could you create that? So what I argued is that you need to somehow measuring, all what you need is a physical mechanism of measuring angle. So that somehow, and then assigning synaptic weight by knowing the angle of the preferred direction and the incoming little starburst vector that coming from different directions, and then giving bigger synaptic weight to the one that has a particular angle with the preferred direction. So the simplest model I can state is this one. What if a ganglion cell is releasing a gradient of molecule of a given type, and you would have four different molecules for the four different directions? And it's such that you have, let's say, more here and less here, or less here and more here, it doesn't matter. And then imagine you have two different receptors on the tip of the starburst cell. At the very tip, there is a receptor, let's say, which is a kinase, and another one proximally, which is a phosphatase. So they work in the opposite direction, and the competition between the two that determines the synaptic rate. By this simple model, if you imagine that this is the ligand, so the ligand times R2 minus the ligand times R1 is the synaptic rate, then essentially the system is hooking up correctly, provided that this is a linear gradient. If it's a nonlinear gradient, turns out that you have problems of not have exactly the synaptic weight.
So both are, I don't understand.
Okay.
No, it's
one gang. Each ganglion cell would release a gradient across the cell.
And the ganglion cells are not overlapping. They're tiled.
That's why. Data. There is some overlap. There is some overlap, and there is still work to do here. This is very theoretical. I'm just saying that this is the simplest model I can say that knowing what we know, that there are no many types of starburst mechanism cells would work. No, there are a million other. You can imagine that there are other models. I like this because of its simplicity, and so we are looking for the molecular components. Sorry? Ganglion says yes, but it's not just a chicken egg, because the ganglions that we already know as an identity, because it projects to the correct, way before this happens, it projects to the correct nucleus. It pushes the problem back to the identity of the ganglion cell, and pushing this idea that the starburst semicrine cell, there is nothing, there's no asymmetry there in the starburst. It's completely symmetric, right? Because it's just a tip, except of this receptor and the tip, but there's no spatial angle encoded. Okay, obviously what you do, but the obvious idea here is that looking at gene expression in starburst semicrine cell will not help you to learn anything, because it's for each locally, it's different for each process. So it must be locally controlled by translation, if that's true.
Yeah.
You are right. So there is a, no, I agree with you. So that it's some. Yeah, so this essentially, we have results already, but I would be no good to Keisuke if we give up the molecules, but for that we have some results. Okay, so obviously what you can do is an experiment. You come with the molecules and try to shift the map, and that's what we are doing right now. We have candidate molecules and try to shift the map. Okay, but this I'm not going to get too specific. So how many minutes I have? Okay, what I'd like to do now is to give you a very, very brief account of something we would like to do. It is a medical project. And this has to do with how understanding of retinal circuits and genetics of cells could lead to rational therapies. What I'd like to point here is rational therapy, is that there is a design here, not just randomly throwing medicine in the patients. It all starts with the question that you raised of, we do some manipulation of cell types in the mouse. How does it relate to human? So what we have done is that, and you will see that we able to get human retinas, post-mortem but alive, in a dish, that we can keep them alive for 3 weeks. And what you will see, what we will talk you, is that culminating that you can go from mouse to human. And the first question we ask, how similar are the cell types? So we target a given cell type, question how similar. So you can use antibody staining, and again, we do a massive amount of antibodies, and you see for many of the strata markers, you see the same in human and mice. The most beautiful one in the human is always, unfortunately, is not as nice because the cutting is not as nice, but choretin labels 3 strata in mouse and 3 strata in human. I mean, it just blows my mind. And then you see PKC labels rod bipolar cells, labeled rod bipolar cells here. Dopamine labels 1 stratum here, it's not so visible. Same stratum in human, CHET labels 2 strata, that's why the directional selective cells, 2 strata in human. So most of the markers, not all, but many markers, is the same. So this is what I'd like to talk to, is how we go for cell type specific treatment to human patients.
Sorry, I don't want to slow down too similarity of cell types. You're looking at amacrine markers largely.
This is a bipolar marker.
Interneuron.
Yeah.
So for the things that you have immunostains for, like melanopsin, are the cell types similar? I'm only asking you because ganglion cells are what you'd like to get at eventually.
No, we are not interested in ganglion cells at all. So that's why we're not looking for ganglion cells. So all what we do is we're not interested so much in ganglion cells, and you will see why. But you are right, so that is very interesting to ask. We haven't looked at melanopsin precisely because we're not interested so much in ganglion cells, but nevertheless, it's very important what you just said. But I'm not going to talk about ganglion cells, and I will tell you why. So what the disease we're looking at is retinitis pigmentosa. It's causing blindness. And I briefly describe the disease. You have 44 gene mutations, and in all the 44, the pathology is the same. And all the 44 genes hit rods. Okay, so these are 44 genes, and you have 160 mutations all hitting rods. Rods degenerate, causing night blindness. But unfortunately, night blindness is really, no, who cares about night blindness because you turn on the light. And why? Because you turn on the light, you don't go to the doctor, because we are surrounded by light. So human society these days does not need rods. And that's a problem, because you get this disease, and the rods are dying out, and by the time you enter the doctor's office, you have overall blindness due to something called the bystander effect. The cones has no mutations, but somehow they lose their outer segment initially, and you became completely blind. And that's the time you walk into the doctor's office. And even the doctor knows about gene therapy, there's absolutely nothing you can do because you don't have the rods that has the bad genes. Okay, this is often not spelled out, that gene therapy is not going to solve these diseases when the cell is not there anymore that you want to treat. So the idea is very simple in the area of optogenetics, is to figure out the strategically important cell types and put them either halorhodopsin or chenorhodopsin. Since the retina has off cells, and off cell get halorhodopsin, and on cell get chenorhodopsin, and all what depends on whether you can target. Well, the targeting cannot be used by Cre recombinism, this and that, because that would make absolutely no sense. But you use a virus that can be used in humans. So the key point will be to find promoters that work in mouse and humans, and that's what I'll show. There are five ways to go here. One, you say, I just don't care about the retinal circuitry, it does nothing. And anyway, I just take a virus, put a KEK promoter that targets all of them, and bring in chenorhodopsin, and that's a perfectly valid approach. And this is, several people are going on that approach. We are sort of so much into retinal circuitry that sort of is just like causing us stomachache to do this kind of thing. So we go with a different approach. But I have to say that this is not discounting the other approach because we just simply don't know. It is just that we studied the retina a long time. So either you can target on ganglion cells and off ganglion cells with halorhodopsin but then you would lose all the computation. So that's again causing a stomachache because all of the ganglion cells would then just be reporting light. Now you can go to on bipolar cells and off bipolar cells. And this we have published some of this. The problem there's not yet good AAVs, one. And plus you would have to put in chenorhodopsin to on and halorhodopsin to off or whatever you want, but this is not really feasible in humans. I mean, if now we are applying for FDA approval, you see that every bit of it, they ask you, why did you put there? And bringing it up, we put in chenorhodopsin, halorhodopsin, that rhodopsin, you just need to go home. So, and then came, there are two more, yeah. Yeah, there's very little surround, actually. I would argue that most what's important is here. Horizontal cell is important. It's all important, yeah. So you can argue that everything is important. So there are two ways of keeping everything. Either you go to A2 amacrine cells, because that's what the rods do, so you can just go there, and we don't yet have viruses. And there's another approach, which I thought personally is completely crazy. So it's an idea, what I will talk is an idea of a graduate student who didn't know about retinal physiology, and that's why he succeeded. So he thought, well, what we do is I just completely reconstruct the retina. I put in halorhodopsin to cones. Now, if you are a retinal physiologist, that makes absolutely no sense. And I'll tell you why. Because they used to have an outer segment, and in dark, that outer segment creates a dark current. Therefore, the photoreceptors are depolarized in the dark and hyperpolarized in light. But if you have no outer segment, you would think that the photoreceptor is hyperpolarized. So if you further hyperpolarizing, you're not going to achieve anything whatsoever because the release is by L-type calcium channels. Okay. So I try to tell him that, you know, it's a great idea, but, you know, why don't you do something else? Look for promoters for A2 amacrine cells. And I was very persistent of telling me every day, and he was very persistent that he thinks that he's brilliant. He doesn't need me for development. And he was actually right for a reason that we still don't understand. So he decided to put inhaler rhodopsin into cones, and it was not my idea. Initially, he wanted to put in rods, and I convinced him there are no rods in the first year graduate student. Now, what I like to say is that your strategy somewhat depends on real-time measurements from human patients. So we have OCT, it's called optical coherence tomography. So in every patient, we can see the layers of cells which are there. So we knew at that time, at least that I checked, that we knew at that time that there are patients who have a lot of cones in the fovea when they are completely blind. So it's not, in that sense, it's not crazy. So that's his approach, putting inhaler rhodopsin here. And so this is the mouse model. We have two mouse models, and it's really important. One that's completely blind from birth, and one that has the same mutations as many of the humans. Okay, and what you see is that this is the photoreceptor layer that slowly disappears. It's P50, and in the fast, it's called fast RD because it's very fast. It disappears all the rods, and here you see a cone cell body layer. What problem is that at P50, this looks like there is a layer of cells. At P80, it looks like there's absolutely no cells whatsoever. It's just one. How do you know there are cones? So this Hunty does. So he then builds an AAV. He builds actually many AAVs, and one of them, when you build viruses, you make wholesale viruses, and one works. So this one worked with this promoter. So he could target very specifically only the photoreceptors, but not specifically cones. But there are no rods later, so it doesn't matter. So what he ends up in this fast model is a layer of cells that has GFP. But the problem is that who tells you these are cones? So I ask him if you can do some stainings. There are no opsins. We look in the literature, opsin disappears at P100. Now, so then came the idea, and that idea developed by many other people, that maybe because if you don't have the markers, the protein, that doesn't mean necessarily that they're not cones. And that's because there's a problem with the mTOR pathway that was demonstrated before. So we put this, so this is how it looks. This is a normal cone, and this is what you get at the end. So to prove that they are cones, we fact sorted out these cells and show on gene chips that they have all the cone markers. Okay, so that is very important, that for a very long time, indeed, by one-third of the mouse lines, these are cones. There you see nothing else by cell bodies, not stained for opsin. And then he simply puts in and I will sort of run through here in 2 or 3 minutes, because this is what you expect. You put inhaler rhodopsin, you get a large current. What was very nice is that if you now look at the current magnitude, this is the untreated, there is no current in the untreated cones, and the wild-type cone current is around 10 picoamp, but what we get here is almost 80 picoamp. So we can really overdrive these cones, and that will give us sensitivity later. And this is the most amazing results to me, because I predicted that, of course, you will drive the cones, and you will have absolutely nothing achieved. But what he sees then is that completely blind mice, he sees on cells, on off cells, and off cells. And you have zero current in the untreated, a lot in the others. Yes? Yeah, I get to there. I get precisely quantification from this. And then... Yeah, but I thought that the cones are hyperpolarized because they have no outer segment. So if the cones are hyperpolarized, and I thought that you can further hyperpolarize, that's great, but you're outside of the L-type calcium channel operating range. For something which we still don't understand, that it's just not how the system works. If you lose, there is a set point that the system sets, and it's not as simple as to imagine that you have no outer segments and you are hyperpolarized.
It's not a switching
assignment. No, not at all. I mean, absolutely not. You can show lateral inhibition. You can show direction selectivity in the retina. And so the conclusion that comes up, and it's very important, that if you have a mouse blind, genetically blind, and also become blind later, like in the normal disease, in both cases, what we get out from the retina is similar. However, in our vehicle, the cortex, and we couldn't get a millivolt out of the cortex from the one that were genetically blind, but we could restore activity in the ones that became blind. So that's really important, is that you should not shoot for initially for people. I mean, this is just mouse, so we don't know, but we probably not shoot for people diseases that were born blind. That we haven't checked, because we haven't looked at. That's a good point. That lays. So that we haven't checked. We don't know. Okay, I'll finish in. So then you look for behavioral and blah, blah, blah. You see behavioral. And then I like to finish in three slides. This is important, so light sensitivity. So if you look at the ranges, these Rhodes cones, IPRGs, and EMPHR, that even though we are overdriving by a lot of current, it's still much less sensitive. And so what you see that although the cones are much less sensitive, but the ganglion cells are much more sensitive because simply they integrate a lot. So we go now these days to the regulatory agencies quite often, and they tell us a very interesting point. They said, how sensitive is your... We says, unfortunately, it's not very sensitive. Say good, because otherwise we would not allow you to use. So that the regulatory agency worries that if we put in something and the patient gets a headache, so we have to able to stop the treatment. And in our case, there is a group in Imperial College that's making us a glass, a stimulation glass, with a video camera outside, inside an array of yellow stimulators. You can just simply take the glass off. So I would not say it's completely optimal. I would love to see it around this range. We actually have to achieve that the patient cannot have vision in a normal room environment that is not currently preferred. Now, how you go for patients, and that was a long time the problem, that how do you know that this promoter will ever work in humans? You cannot just go and inject humans. And even if it works in monkeys, there are no good monkey models. And this is where a lot helped us. These postmortem human retinas that they get from Amsterdam 36 hours after removal from dead patients. And a friend of mine in Paris worked out to keep them in culture for 3 weeks. So we thought that, well, what we try is drop some viruses on and let's see what happens. So what happens is you can make a human retina light sensitive back after a week in a dish. And this is shown here, is that these are now photoreceptor responding to light of a human retina. And what we are now realized, of course, that now we're not going to study monkeys, but we'll study human retinal processing using these techniques. So we are working on it very hard. We still have to make, we change viruses and we have to make more efficient. But that's what we try to do is look at foveal organizations by these approaches. And the very last slide is that of course, the way we select the patients is two criteria. One is that they have still cones left in the fovea, and they have no, the Goldman test is empty, so what we call is legally blind. We screened already more than 1,000 patients. I mean, we means it, my collaborator, José Sahel in Paris, is a large clinic where they will try to bring this forward. Thank you. No, of course. I mean, we tried it all out. I mean, people are kind to send this us. So we made AVs for every single existing one. The proton pumps are better, clearly. The problem with proton pumps is that all our toxicity data, so I didn't show you toxicity data, is done by halodopsin, and just this worry about hydrogen and pH of killing cells long run. So it's a decision that you have to make, is that every day there'll be a new one. So tomorrow you get a call from whatever, this friend or that friend, there's a better pump and better this. You can just keep never doing anything because you wait for the next one. So a decision at one point you make, because once you make a viral vector and you apply for European regulators, you stick with that until the end. There's no way of changing anything in it. not on a bit. So currently, we think that we just stick around with Halo Robson. So the tile, so it's interesting, obviously, because there is some sort of tiling property with some overlap, most of the types coming from large ganglion cell types, right? Most of the types are large ganglion cell types, because, okay, so in each patch, you have 3,000 ganglion cell bodies in the retina. And you can do the numerics that if you have, you know, small ganglion cells, a lot of them, which is one type. But if you have large ganglion cells, in order to fit the 3,000 cells, you need a lot of types of those. Obviously, you see an explosion of types for large ganglion cells. So for small, right? Because, as I said, you know, you can have, you know, 300 ganglion cell is already a type covering completely the retina. So if you have in each millimeter square, you have around 3,200 ganglion cell number. And then this would be a millimeter square. And let's say you have small ganglion cells that are 100 microns. So they would be, you would have 10 times 10 of those. So that would account for 100. So that would account from 100 of the 3,200. But that's the smallest. Or I don't know, what's the smallest you have seen? What's the smallest ganglion cell? Dendrite, I mean, it's around 100.
In the mouse, it seems like there's a lot. I would argue that there are about 70% of the ganglion cells in the mouse are on off directions, like the ganglion cells are very small and very large. So there are many of them. I mean, you know, 2,000 of each subtype. So.
But what's the dendritic field of those?
Oh, it can be as small as just, you know, 100 microns.
Yeah, so that's what I said. So if you have 100 microns, then you would have 100 cells out of the 3,200. So they overlap a little bit. So I would argue differently than Andy, but I would just say that there are a lot of ganglion cell types. And that depends on the time. If you have a large cell, you have a few. A small cell, you have a lot. Yeah. There's a very strict large cells have few. Small cells has a lot. Now there is an overlap factor, and which depends on a bit on the cell type. Yeah, exactly. The smaller ones are more numerous. Yeah. So the one that we also record from is called the local edge detector. We have it genetically labeled, and that is absolutely amazing behavior. It's an on-off cell. It's very small. And there is a delay in the excitation. So there is an inhibition that it receives that is faster than excitation and delays excitation. So but it delays in a different amount and on and off. So it's looking for a feature that we have absolutely no clue of. But there is a very complex computation in that little cell about the timing and spatial feature that we don't know what it is. I mean, we have done one experiment where then now I am approaching a tree, you know, and what you see amazing is local edge detectors that for a while they follow features and then they lose it. So they follow, lose. Whether that's what they are doing, we don't know. I mean, again, to get, usually one is at least my definition of finding what I call a trigger feature, if every fact you find fits it. It's always easy to say, well, it's a local edge detector, must look for local edges because it does not respond for big objects. But it's not enough. I think you really have that every part of the circuitry is sort of tuned to that particular feature, then you can be more convinced that what you're looking at is a real trigger feature. Salamander is very different. So I spent a lot, like 5 years of my life in salamander. There, the salamander, for example, spatial processing is very, very weak surrounds you have. And I think that's just very different from mammals. Yeah, that's no good. Sorry, it's my own opinion. No, so a problem with the random dots. Now go ahead. It doesn't come out. I mean, Vijay can tell you a lot about why it's not coming out. He can quantify that. But the problem is that once you show dots, surround inhibition is evoked when there is a particular stimulus correlated in the surround. If you just do random stimuli, you have to wait probably 2,000 years to get those. So almost everything that's interesting is not coming out, and this is noted by Marcus and many other people, is that it's good to localize your cells, but you know, reverse correlation is not particularly good to understand what the cells are doing. Of course, we're much smaller because you see the bipolar cell input and then you don't see much about the inhibition. I mean, the more you go further, the more spatial correlations you need to get it and the less you will see it. I'm particularly against reverse correlation, so. So our thoughts is precisely what you just mentioned in a little caveat, is that if we calculate this gradient, the numerics, it's hard to imagine that there's so little. If you have a global gradient, you have to locally amplify it. And this is just a problem. I think everything starts with a global gradient. Completely agree with you. And that's where the asymmetry is really, really set up. And then something, these local amplifiers, the ganglions, is reading of the gradient and creating. We don't know. No. Yeah. So this is, we don't know. But I would agree with you that this is where it starts. And whether this will be read out by the ganglion cell and amplifies it, or it's enough, this is yet out for. Well, the question is that F means my read out the global gradient. What the molecules we are really interested in is that the one that possibly provided for the correlation, the angle measurement, what I call. Again, there are a number of candidates, and as you see that, you know, F is on the list, and you know all the others, and it's too early because you can get really wrong on this candidate. So I can tell you a name, and then it's complete. But again, the model is just a model. I really like to tell you there's actually no evidence for this.
Well, on the same note, I mean, it takes 2 days and it takes something for you to develop, right?
Yeah.
It's kind of a long time.
Ooh, for us, we thought it's a very short time. We were so amazed. That's good to hear. It's good to hear. So I
guess it's a lot more focused. But I mean, it's kind of a great thing.
No. So what we think is that something, so it's not that the chemical gradient to set it up, but you need, and first of all, it just the average takes you 2 days. I mean, this is our resolution. We just know, I don't say it takes 2 days. And the retina is a wave that all the development goes in the middle and then later. So we're averaging together a lot of events. I'm not saying it's going, it can be, you know, hours. It can be much shorter, but I think it's bounded by the 2 days.
I was just wondering if you quantified the attention that this gamma set is studied does not project to the superheterogeneous NGN. It's projected to the NG, and I told you that it's Gambidian terminators. And one can get into, it's always the question is, you want to do some screening or want to go to be honest, I'm not a developmental person. It is Ketsuke who knows about the development. So we trust, I just don't know. I mean, there are many ways you can go. I mean, you can go sort of quantify the projection zone. It's really that we don't know. When, then you don't know the results, you guess what you would like to do, and then it either succeeds or not.
When you quantify the method,
right? We just don't care about the target, right? We just look at in the retina, because we now have at least one clear number is P6 and P8 between something must happen in the retina. So what I want to do right now, and what we're doing, is isolating the retina P6 and see if it indeed will happen. If that happens in vitro, I can just forget about the what we call the extraocular bond, this part.
Yeah, I know it's a blah blah blah. Could you actually just put the behavioral data that you acquired from the mouse? Can you show that slide?
Which one? The two.
That's the cuties.
Sorry, I keep.
This is a Prusky pen?
It's similar, yeah. The Prusky would not work because we have no kinetic intensity, so we set up something that we have. It's an arena. It's more like this arena kind that people use for the ocular. It's similar, but we have very strong LEDs and we can change the. But it's definitely.
Maybe you
can
help clarify something. So there's a lot of discussion these days about how many ganglion cell subtypes are there. So how many movies did that pigeon really exist? And the question that I'm not so much looking for an absolute number, I'd like to know, is that really the question that we should be asking, or is it really a question of how many retinal circuits there are? You showed one that's flexible, so you know, should we even care how many subtypes there are? Is it does that should tell us anything?
I think we should, because I mean, you're studying, you know, how. I don't know the answer. My guess would be that we should, because I think the way to go with exactly what we do is that you know, look at the ganglion cell subtypes and we'll try to understand what happens. And I think that you should know all the subtypes, probably, I don't, you shouldn't care, because there are many, there's no way. I think conceptually the problem is really a hard one. Is that this idea that two ganglion cells project the LGN and then comes to the cortex, and X and Y is just simply wrong from beginning to end. And so, you know, as everybody knows it, so we know that there are many, many ganglion cells project the LGN, usually directional circuits are usual, and what happens in the cortex is unclear. So I think to understand how these types really group, so you need an underlying tracer, you need general boxing, somehow to get a clue on what happens. So like the corneal cellular, just recently talked to Kevin Martin, and he says, okay, yeah, we have X and Y in the corneal cellular, that might be in all 30 types. So what happens in them is what we do. So going back to the question of types, so we try to calculate this, maybe more interesting.
Focus on this. Thank you.